Welcome into the Best in True Crime Podcasting. This is True Crime Tuesday. I'm Tim Dennis. I am really excited about today's show, and I'll tell you why. About 6 months ago, I was sitting around, and I was sitting around and I was watching an episode of 60 Minutes, and there was a feature about Havana Syndrome. And normally you hear about things like this, let's just say in sources on the internet that I don't want to say aren't reputable, because there are articles about this that are reputable, but you see it in websites that maybe don't have mainstream media headers to them. So when 60 Minutes starts talking about Havana Syndrome and starts having real agents that used to work for the CIA, real agents that used to work for real three-letter agencies that come forward and talk about how they feel they've been persecuted. And not only that, that our government won't support them when it comes time to get treated. It's pretty alarming and pretty shocking, to be honest with you. So I have kind of followed it along the way and read some different articles on Havana Syndrome. And it's quite shocking. If you've never listened or heard about Havana Syndrome, we're going to tell you a little bit about it today. And we have a very special guest today on True Crime Tuesday. Now, we're going to kind of delve into the paranormal side of things as well, which is our favorite thing to do here, as it's part of Darkness Radio as well, True Crime Tuesday is. So we're going to mix a little bit of the paranormal along with True Crime today. And Frank Milburn is with us today. He's a former British military intelligence officer and paratrooper with over 22 years of experience advising clients operating in medium to high risk environments from North Africa to the Middle East and LATAM, LATAM are the initials. He has consulted to a wide range of FTSE 100, Fortune 500, aerospace, and government clients. Frank is an alumnus of the Royal Military Academy Sandhurst and attended the London School of Economics as an Army scholar. He has written for a number of globally ranked think tanks and publications, including the Middle East Economic Survey, the Combating Terrorism Center at West Point, and the Institute for National Security Studies at Tel Aviv University. He is an affiliated researcher with the Begin Sadat Center for Strategic Studies at Bar-Ilan University, which published two lengthy papers by Frank on unexplained aerial phenomena and next generation aerospace technologies. He's also a member of the Scientific Coalition for UAP Studies. I want to welcome into True Crime Tuesday, Frank Milburn. Frank, thank you very much for being with us today. I can't tell you how awestruck I am to have you here today. I really do appreciate your time.
Thank you very much for the honor of being on your show. It was very nice getting a call from you.
I want to start off, let's start off with the topic at hand, and then I want to work our way to eventually the more sensational topic of UAP, but I want to start with Havana Syndrome, and a topic that in itself you may think is sensational, but it really is not. And the fact that this topic has now become something that has been put on a major network like 60 Minutes and CBS. Explain to us first what Havana Syndrome is for our listeners that don't know.
Certainly. What we've seen in the kind of sort of the mainstream news, there's been a number of articles and reports about attacks on embassy staff, intelligence officials at various locations where the U.S. has, ambassadorial representation around the world. And the news stories tended to concentrate on sort of use of directed energy acoustic weapons, which were causing people to have effects from, nausea to memory loss to some quite kind of deleterious health conditions. And this is something that the U.S. government says that it's been looking to. I've been delving down into it more in the context of aerospace, defense, and UAP. Because I've been speaking to a number of different scientists, people who kind of cross the spectrum from the science community working with people like, the Department of Energy, Department of Defense, NASA, those kind of areas, and with you know, sort of people in the intelligence community, in the U.S. intelligence community, and people who have actual experience both as victims of Havana syndrome, as it's called, and also those who have you know, scientific knowledge of it, and how malign actors go about using effectively the means to attack these people who are involved in science and aerospace and defense.
Which in itself is chilling when you say that. And man, I have a thousand questions with just that little bit you've said. Now, with Havana syndrome obviously has to come from somewhere. What causes Havana syndrome? What are they being attacked with that causes this issue?
Well, I'm told that by the scientists that I speak to, that it's not actually acoustic energy which is being used as directed energy, as a directed energy weapon. I'm told that the sort of the medium of choice is microwave energy, to literally kind of fry the victim. And the means used are anything from sort of portable directed energy weapons, which can be carried in a vehicle and can be directed at a victim, to, I'm told by one scientist, that, and we can go into this in further discussion because I've got quite a lot of detail on it.
Sure.
That your mobile phone and your router can actually be hacked so that the frequencies can be changed to effectively emit radiation that is harmful to your body and can cause, over a long period of time, it causes permanent damaging effects and eventually potentially leading to death. I was told by one scientist who's been a victim of it. They said, and I'll quote, they said, Russia has been hitting a select list of U.S. scientists with sublethal, and this is talking about nerve agents, dosed and directed energy weapon attacks for at least the past 30 years. They fully realized that leaving a trail of dead bodies would force a public investigation and force an international incident. So the strategy has been to employ sublethal tactics that simply wreck your health and make you dramatically less productive without killing you. It's slow murder that is roughly equivalent to actual torture, unquote.
Okay, now that is just scary. I, you know, so you're saying that Russia in itself can hack either our routers or our cell phones and can target any particular U.S. citizen at any time, and it could be a high-ranking citizen, and just bam, like that, take them out.
Effectively, yes. But I mean, this isn't really, this shouldn't really be that surprising. I mean, we know. We know hostile actors, their playbook, especially the Russian playbook for dealing with enemies, whether it's directed energy weapons or, you know, some kind of a nerve agent or a radioactive isotope. So Georgi Markov was stabbed with a poison umbrella on London Bridge in 1978. Okay, he was a Bulgarian dissident, and the KGB helped his country effectively take him out with some kind of an agent that was injected into his leg. Then you had the famous case of Alexander Litvinenko, who was poisoned with a radioactive isotope in 2006 in London. You had the more recent Skirpal case in 2018, where nerve agent was deployed by Russian military intelligence. And all of these took place in the UK. You can also look at the Navalny poisoning in Russia, you know, the Russian dissident. So he was poisoned in 2020 in Russia, again, with a nerve agent. He spent a lot of time recovering in a hospital in Germany. So I think, you know, we need to think about directed energy weapons and Havana syndrome as part of an adversarial playbook. So it could be, you know, lethal microwave energy as opposed to acoustic ones, and, you know, used in conjunction with other means like nerve agent. So I think in that respect, I'm told, you know, the Cold War never really ended. And if you're looking at this, you have to look at it not just in terms of adversarial playbook. Also, you know, the Americans and the Israelis and Western intelligence agencies have done the same thing. So you only have to look at, for example, Iran's nuclear program. So that's been the target of impressive espionage and sabotage efforts. The Americans and the Israelis, they went after the Iranian centrifuges with a computer virus Stuxnet. That was back in 2010. And the Israelis have gone after nuclear scientists with assassinations, including a recent very prominent one outside Tehran, where they used a mobile remotely controlled gun platform. So I think that given the prizes involved in aerospace technology and also in, you know, nuclear technology and weapons, you know, advanced weapons technology in general, everybody's going to have a playbook with trying to take out the adversary's capabilities. And that includes the scientists who design those weapons.
if I can backtrack for just a second, when it comes to the actual mechanics of using these tools to try and take someone out, is this just a matter of boosting the RF energy within the tool to start to fry someone's brain with Havana syndrome, or how is this mechanism delivered in order to get this energy into a person in order to deliver the fatal shot, so to speak?
Well, that's quite interesting that you asked that. I'm told that by one scientist who's been a victim of it, that the frequencies can be changed through hacking on your mobile phone, on your router. And I actually got an email this morning, which was quite coincidental after you called me yesterday, from an executive at a global defense group, effectively, a multinational aerospace and defense company. And they said to me, "Hi, Frank, interesting podcast the other day," which was that UFO podcast, "in which you mentioned the theories regarding Havana syndrome. We like to stay abreast of such things. So I floated this to some engineers here at his company." So one engineer said, "You wonder where's the antenna? Axons in the brain? External signal would need to be injected into synaptic terminal. Axons length, many centimeters in length." He says, "It's the perfect resonant antenna." Then another engineer says, "Havana syndrome is almost certainly due to the heating effects of microwave radiation, especially at the microwave oven frequency of 2,450 megahertz, which is strongly absorbed by water, which then heats up and cooks food in an oven. But this requires hundreds of watts of RF concentrated locally. Chemical or biological reactions, neurological message speeds are far too slow, milliseconds at best, to respond to instant radiation, unless the instant power heats up the neurons, other parts enough to cause molecular disruption and damage. Vibrations or sonic sounds of a few hertz can be felt by the body, sometimes causing an urgent need to visit the laboratory. Mobile phones do not put out enough power, 1 watt maximum, to cause significant tissue heating in the head. Cheers." I mean, you've got different opinions there. They actually came back with some more information for me, because I said thank you to the emails. Uh-huh. I got a whole page back from the engineers. They were saying lower frequencies and harmonics could be used to target resonant cavities within the body. I'm thinking this could be a lot less obvious than targeted high power. It too could cause bad headaches, bleeding from the ears, and stomach problems, but I'm no expert. The exact type of injuries received would give a good indication as to what frequencies were being deployed against individuals. I read that Dr. Gary Nolan, and we can delve into this, sure, has been asked to look at this, and I've seen images of MRI scans showing scarring on the brain. That's all very, very interesting. It says the signals travel from wherever they are produced through the body by way of the cells with the help of the axons, which are part of the neuron that transmits signals, like wires from the cell body to the next neuron. These signals flow through the nervous system in the body using a system of chemical neurotransmitters, which are created by neurons. Neuron is another word for nerve cell, and these cells can communicate with each other through connections called synapses. I'm basically told by one of the victims, and they are, you know, a genius level scientist. Mm-hmm. I've vetted them thoroughly. I've seen papers that they've written. They know people that I know, including a person that we know in common. And they told me that, you know, basically they've got traumatic brain injury from it, like the scans that Dr. Gary Nolan showed in his Vice article and the New York Post article. They told me they've got traumatic brain injury. They've got Parkinson's. I've actually seen them convulsing when we've had, when we've been video conferencing, because we speak fairly regularly. And they have irradiated skin. They've got burns on their skin as well. And they have all kinds of digestive problems, which seems to chime with what these engineers have been telling me.
It's amazing. I'm sitting here gobsmacked. I guess, too, with the idea that it's just so easy. It's just such an easy weapon to use. And at this point in time in our world history, it seems like we're on this delicate brink of conflict. And people may think, well, are we really? But look at around the world right now. You've got Russia wanting to invade the Ukraine and the U.S. stepping up to try to defend the Ukraine. And there are some very inflammatory messages coming from Russia when it comes to, you know, if the U.S. decides to defend the Ukraine, Russia has basically said they won't stand for anything, any interference on the U.S.'s part. and that this could be the start of a war, for lack of a better term, a world war.
I agree thoroughly, and I've been monitoring that situation. I'm told by a couple of leading scientists that now the portable directed energy weapon is now lower tech actors, but who've got access to the to sort of financial resources and who've got the connections, they can actually get those portable directed energy weapon generators now, and that the weapon of choice, the means of choice for sophisticated state actors, like Russia, China, and quite possibly like the US and others, is the hacking of the phones, the hacking of electrical equipment around you, like routers, because you don't actually have to physically be, line of sight to your target. So you're not putting your own, intelligence officers / saboteur at risk of discovery.
Wow, interesting. So explain to me why aerospace scientists? I sit and think about this. I mean, space to me seems like, especially in the U.S., we've privatized most of our space travel and most of our space activities. NASA, just launched the James Webb telescope. But it seems to me that we've handed things off to Elon Musk. We've handed things off to other entrepreneurs. Why is it that we're going after aerospace engineers and aerospace scientists?
Which, so you mean in terms of the hostile actors, why are they doing it?
Yeah.
I mean, that's a very good question. There's actually a very interesting letter from to the William Lynn, Deputy Secretary of Defense. This is a letter dated June 2009. The writer is Senator Harry Reid, rest in peace, who died recently. Mm-hmm. He was heavily involved in the Advanced Aerospace Weapon System Applications Program, in setting it up and trying to get funding for it. And he's been involved very much in sort of pushing the unexplained aerial phenomena issue. And it's worth reading some excerpts from his letter, because it explains precisely why you'd want to go after people involved in advanced aerospace technologies and aerospace in general. So this letter is trying to set up the Advanced Aerospace Weapon System Applications Program. It's trying to put it onto a special access program footing. And he says, in order to further our effort, he said, dear Secretary Lynn, in order to further our effort in recognizing emerging disruptive aerospace technologies, technical studies have been conducted in regard to advanced lift, propulsion, the use of unconventional materials and controls, signature reduction, weaponry, human interface, and human effects. And he says, much progress has been made with the identification of several highly sensitive, unconventional aerospace-related findings. Given the current rate of success, the continued study of these subjects will likely lead to technology advancements that in the immediate near term will require extraordinary protection. Due to the sensitivities of the information surrounding aspects of this program, I require your assistance in establishing a restricted special access program with a bigoted access list. Okay, a bigoted access list is basically a list of people who have special access to a program. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So then he's saying, in order to support the effort, he says, a small but highly specialized cadre of Department of Defense and private sector individuals are necessary. So they must be specialized in the areas of advanced sciences, sensors, intelligence, counterintelligence, and advanced aerospace engineering. Given the likelihood that these technologies will be applied to future systems involving spaceflight, weapons, communications, and propulsion, the standard management and safeguarding procedures for classified information are not sufficient. Even the use of conventional special access program protocols will not adequately ensure that all aspects of the project are properly secured. Now, then he goes on, he says, specific methodologies used to study unconventional technology may require nuanced approaches that will undoubtedly be of significant interest, if not a top priority, to adversarial foreign intelligence security services. And then it goes on, undue attention by government or private sector entities not involved in the program or any international interest will directly or indirectly interfere with the daily mission and perhaps threaten the overall success of the program. Due to the highly specialized nature of the personnel involved in the program, the overt acknowledgement of their participation in the program will lead to unnecessary security and counterintelligence risk. And it says, then he's talking about specialized individuals from the DoD, the scientific community, or academia. And he says, adequate protection of their identities or affiliation is critical to avoid unnecessary scrutiny. Without the appropriate restricted special access program protection, the cost associated with the compromise will be significantly higher than the cost associated with a properly administered restricted special access program. Then he says protection of industry partnerships and participation is critical. Okay. And then he says, associated exotic technologies likely involve extremely sophisticated concepts within the world of quantum mechanics, nuclear science, electromagnetic theory, gravitics, and thermodynamics. Given that all of these have the potential to be used with catastrophic effects by adversaries, an unusually high degree of operational security and read-on discretion is required. It is essential that the government and military personnel who are already involved with this program are assigned to further support the program in a restricted special access program capacity. And then this is the kicker at the end. Okay. He says, ultimately, the results of the program that he's talking about will not only benefit the U.S. government, but I believe will directly benefit DODs in ways not yet imagined. The technological insight and capability gained will provide the U.S. with a distinct advantage over any foreign threats and allow the U.S. to maintain its preeminence as a world leader. So that's why.
Interesting. So allow me to be a little dumbfounded and a little dumb here, Frank, but is this basically saying that we have an active aerospace weapons technology program happening in space right now?
Well, absolutely. I mean, if you look at the the National Defense Authorization Act that's just been signed, I mean, there's a whole section there on setting up an office to examine unidentified aerial phenomena, establishment of a science plan, to look at all those areas that we just discussed, all those technological areas with a review to funding for research. So that's very much so. And if you look, there was a letter in my, an email in my first paper from Dr. Eric Davis, who was heavily involved also in ORSAP, the Advanced Aerospace Weapon System Applications Program, its successor, the Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program. ORSAP was DIA. ATIP, the successor, was run out of the Office of Naval Intelligence. Okay, then it became the UAP Task Force. He's been involved with that as well. I saw an email from him to prominent American physicist Dr. Chuck Sarfatti talking about exotic or UFO propulsion physics research. And Dr. Eric Davis says, actual research falls under the purview of the military service labs and the Department of Energy labs. Your UFO propulsion idea will have to stand up to scrutiny by the defense science, military service labs, and DOE labs review boards and panels. And if you look at the Australian National Archives, there's a guy, Dr. Harry Turner, and I got this information from investigative journalist Ross Coulthart, who put it out there very kindly. Okay. And by 1966, they're already around, like there were over 40 anti-gravity programs being looked at by the American government and various universities.
So we're well underway.
It's well underway. Yeah. And I mean, this is why, so there's very good reasons why, and not just, the UAP programs, but aerospace programs in general, there's very good reasons why they need to be shrouded in security, and why, according to Dr. Eric Davis, the security costs, for example, of UAP programs are up to 10 times higher than the cost of the programs themselves. You only have to think in terms of personnel security. So, I mean, I've got a background in counterintelligence from the military. And so, I mean, I understand, all about sort of, keeping things on the quiet. I've also got a background in close protection. I work with the U.S. government, the State Department, the DOD, protecting sort of senior State Department officials and generals in Iraq in the early part of the Iraq insurgency. So I've got a pretty good idea about, the personnel security issues and why, people would be going after those scientists. So it really doesn't surprise me when these people are telling me that they're being targeted. Eric Davis, actually, he talks about special access programs, as, Senator Reid was talking about. And he says they're extremely costly to maintain. Let me tell you, the cost to maintain information, personnel, and physical security for a special access program could be 10 times larger than the cost of the program itself. The purpose of the black program with the special access program security wrap is that you've got to limit the information exposure to the information to as few as people as possible in order to produce the maximum security protection against espionage by the enemy. And I'd also include to that espionage, and also sabotage, because the programs are being sabotaged if you're taking out the scientists. And it doesn't have to be somebody who's directly inside a special access program. It could be a peripheral scientist or contractor. Somebody who's producing a piece of machinery or some essential element that they need in that program. It's a bit like, if you want to sabotage, the manufacture of a particular model of car. Mm-hmm. There's all different kind of parts that you could sabotage in the supply chain so that vehicle can't be produced.
Now, let me ask you this: is the sabotage going on because another country needs that part, say Russia or China, or is it because we are so far ahead that they need to slow us down so they can catch up. Because, I mean, we see China claiming, or not only claiming, but saying that they have reached their own heights as far as getting out into space and doing things with their programs. We maybe don't see as much. Well, we do see as much, I guess, as far as the International Space Station and whatnot with Russia's aerospace program. But are these countries on the same level as us, or are they quite a bit further behind?
Very difficult to say. I'd say the Chinese, and in my humble opinion, the Chinese are behind. But you only have to look open source reports and also the DoD's report to Congress on China in 2021. And also this year's DoD report to Congress, Chinese leaders stressed the imperative of meeting key information markers. So by 2049, China wants to field a world-class military, and they effectively want to be the preeminent economic and technological power in the world, right, by 2050. Mm-hmm. We know that the Chinese are interested in UAP. There's been some open source information about it. They know definitely the Americans are interested in it. And we also know that the Russians and the Soviets before had a very active UAP program. Dr. Eric Davis, I mean, I quoted him in an email in my first paper. So he says, we were tasked to extrapolate 2009 to 2010 engineering physics of a variety of technical topics that were published as 38 defense intelligence reference document reports, right? So these defense intelligence reference documents, these 38 documents, they were one of the products that the Advanced Aerospace Weapons System Applications Program produced for the DIA. So he said, we need to extrapolate these to the year 2050 in order to determine whether American engineering physics can approach or approximate or not the observed characteristics and capabilities of Tic Tacs, UAPs, in a scenario where the Tic Tac UAP might become a future threat to the U.S. If you look at the recent book, Skinwalkers of the Pentagon, which was written by Dr. Com Kolliher and Dr. Lukatsky. Dr. Lukatsky, he was director of the Advanced Aerospace Weapons System Application Program at DIA. Dr. Com Kolliher, he was deputy director of the Bigelow Aerospace subsidiary, mm-hmm. Bigelow Aerospace Advanced Space Studies, which was effectively the subcontractor which was servicing the ORSAT program. In the book, they are, and Harry Reid is mentioned frequently in the book as well, they are constantly worried not only about the potential threat of UAP, but also, you know, significantly the threat of, you know, the risk posed by China or Russia getting there before. And we know that the Russians have been very interested in and have an advanced UFO program. There was a British report called Project Condyne, what's called Unidentified aerial phenomena in the UK air defense region. This was produced in 1998, 1999. It was declassified in 2006. They said, basically, in the report, they quote this guy, Colonel Sokolov, who was heavily involved in the Soviet UAP program. And he was saying that, that the Russians had lost pilots to UAP, and they definitely considered UAP as a threat. And he also said, and this is another kicker, he said that the Soviets and then the Russians, they wanted to understand these technologies, and they had the same fear that the Americans did. They were worried that the Americans would get ahead before the Russians did.
Interesting. At this point, Frank, let's take our break. When we come back, I want to address how this all ties into Space Force and what exactly was the purpose behind Space Force, and does it tie into what we're talking about right now? When we come back, more with Frank Milburn here on the Best in True Crime Talk Radio. You're listening to True Crime Tuesday. Welcome back to the Best in True Crime Podcasting. This is True Crime Tuesday. I'm Tim Dennis. Fascinating, fascinating stuff this Tuesday, folks. We're talking to Frank Milburn, and we are talking about not only Havana Syndrome, but we're also talking about the reasons behind Havana Syndrome, and we're also talking about UAPs and technology behind UAPs and why all this ties together and why all this espionage is going on behind the scenes behind different countries and the true crime aspects behind it as well. Frank, before we went to break, I teased everybody about the creation of Space Force and how it ties into the espionage between different countries and why Space Force was created in the first place. Maybe you can give us a little bit of background behind it, because it came up very suddenly. In fact, I think amongst the American people, there was no reference as to why Space Force was formed. And I think it was a little bit of a chuckle between everybody, like, Space Force, what are we defending in space? Ha, ha, ha. But I don't think the American public got it. So if you could you explain to us why Space Force and what is it exactly that they're doing?
Well, Space Force was effectively a kind of a new branch of the Air Force that was created. But it's nothing really new to those who've been watching it. All it's doing is it's tying together the various sub-commands, you know, within the Army, the Air Force, the Navy, and intelligence community, who are looking at effectively the military use of space and the military exploitation of space. So, you know, there were people transferred across from other branches. So Space Force is really just an amalgamation of a better organization, shall we say, of current American capabilities with a view to improving those capabilities. Because control of space and the militarization of space, I mean, even going back to the 1960s, the Americans and others were worried about, you know, the militarization of space, because you only have to look, you know, the proliferation of satellites there. We rely on them for communications. We require, you know, we require them for navigation, all kinds of critical infrastructure. And, you know, the possibility now we've seen with the ability, you know, to target the Earth from space. Because if you're running a conflict with a major peer competitor like Russia or China, you need to have control of space, and you don't want to lose your space assets. And the Russians and the Chinese have been making increasing advances, not only in areas like, you know, hypersonic weaponry, but also in anti-satellite capabilities. So that's really why Space Force was, came into being. It was to protect the high ground, just as in, you know, the First World War, you know, the sort of first combat aircraft appeared, and it was to, you know, to control the skies. He who controls the high ground, or she who controls the high ground, if you've got a female president, mm-hmm. then, basically wins the war.
Is there a true danger? I mean, we don't really think about how much we depend on satellites, but even you and I speaking right now, the way we are across the country, across the world, we're depending on satellites. We're depending on satellite technology in order for you and I to speak. And every day we hold this thing in our hand called a phone, which can be used, I guess, now for detrimental purposes. But, you know, we depend on it so much, this technology in our hand, to give us our communication, to guide us, to do whatever we need to do, to order things. But it can be brought down so quickly with just bringing down a satellite. Is there a true danger, because we all depend on it worldwide, these satellites, is there a true danger of an enemy country taking out a satellite?
Well, very much so. Not just one satellite, but a multitude. I mean, you know, if they can take out your constellation, then you can't communicate, or it's very difficult to communicate with, with your vessels, with your military assets. It's very difficult for you to target your weapons. Okay, it's impossible for you to navigate. We've seen, like in Ukraine, for example, the Russian use of electronic warfare, targeting Ukrainian communications. Okay, and targeting drones. So if you take out the enemy's ability to see, command, control, then, you have a distinct advantage. And, China, I think they still believe, okay, they can't win a major war alone against the United States. But certainly in a conflict, they'd want to, blind America, to disable America's ability to command and communicate and to target.
Is there any such thing as updating an article of war to keep that out of an article of war, or does that seem like ethical warfare to you?
Well, whether it's ethical or not, I mean, they tried. I believe in 1966 there was a treaty on trying to limit militarization of space. But I mean, everybody's going ahead with it anyway. China's very interested in the moon. What happens if they start putting weapons on the moon? Dr. Jack Sarfati, in my first paper, he was talking about Skinwalker Ranch, and he was talking about the Stargate portal 1,000 feet above the ranch, and he said it could easily be used as a WMD. He said it can be controlled to be benign in terms of a portal, or it can fry the area below. So it's got a dual capability as both a warp drive. The Tic-Tac has a dual capability as both a warp drive and as a traversable wormhole portal. Now, Dr. Gary Nolan has said that what he's seen in terms of, you know, traumatic brain injury and directed energy use at Skinwalker Ranch. He actually said in the Vice article, he said, with one of the patients that happened on Skinwalker Ranch, given how deep into the brain the damage went, we can actually estimate the amount of energy required in the electromagnetic wave someone aimed at them. We don't think that has anything to do with UAP. We think that some sort of state actor, and again, we think it was some sort of state actor, and again, related to Havana syndrome somehow. But another source that I spoke to, they said, well, the Soviets had all kinds of crazy space weapons. So they posited the idea of having a very, very powerful directed energy weapon in space that could be used to fry targets on the ground.
Let's talk a little bit about, I take it you've seen the Skinwalker Ranch television show that's on?
Yeah, absolutely. And I've had extensive conversation as well with Colonel John Alexander, who featured kind of heavily in both my peer-reviewed papers, who was actually there when Bob Bigelow bought the ranch, sort of pre National Institute of Discovery Science days. So please, yeah, go ahead.
Sure. In the seasons that have been on History Channel, it's quite in a way it's quite revealing. In another, it's a little confusing as to what they find. In one respect, they lean towards UAP, and they show UAP at one point in the series. In another, they kind of hint to the paranormal, to spirits there. In another, they also find extremely high radiation on the property. In your opinion, as you've pointed out, there is some Havana syndrome issues going on there. And you just pointed out that Dr. Jack Sefardi has said something about a portal there. What do you surmise is going on there at the ranch?
I think I haven't been there. Okay. So I can only rely on, the books I've read and the people I've spoken to, but it seems to be a whole load of a conglomeration of a very high strangeness, everything from UFOs, wormhole portals, weird cryptid creatures that, get shot and seem to be immune to sort of ballistic weaponry and can like regenerate themselves. Poltergeist activity, cameras being taken out in view of other cameras, but nothing shows up on the playback. Some really malicious activity, exsanguination of cattle within several hundred meters in broad daylight of the rancher while he's going about his work, and there's no visible means of how it was done to the cow, and so there's no blood around it and that type of thing, and with surgical precision. So I think it's very, very fascinating. And also what Dr. Gary Nolan's comments that, some sort of state actor may have been involved at Skinwalker using directed energy weapons. That wouldn't surprise me, because I know under the Advanced Aerospace Weapon System Applications Program, if you look at the book Skinwalkers at the Pentagon that I mentioned by Lukatsky, Kelleher, and George Knapp, the DIA was concerned about, the potential threat emanating from Skinwalker Ranch. The ability, and I'm reading between the lines here, the ability of UAP to pass through a portal and come into your airspace. So you've got something that you've got a portal basically into the United States over which you have no control. Things can just come and go as they please. So you could see how, that would be unsettling. Cryptids, that I said, seem to be impervious to gunshots and can regenerate themselves. So that would be very unsettling as well. The kind of invisible malign activity that was going on. If something can exsanguinate a 200 or 300 pound calf, so what can that do to a human being? So you'd be concerned about those potential threats as the DIA, and you'd also want to understand how to counter those phenomena and those technologies, if they are indeed technologies, and you'd want to prevent anybody else from doing so. And you'd want to acquire those capabilities for yourself, because it's the Defense Intelligence Agency, right?
Right. I try to wrap my head around the DIA using a weapon like that, and I want to get back a little bit to Havana syndrome here, using it against its own people to keep them away from somewhere like Skinwalker Ranch or even agents of its own in order to keep them in line. Have you seen reports like this, and can you talk about reports like this and things
that
you've
seen? I don't believe it was the DIA. I believe it was a malign actor doing it. Explain
what you mean by that.
Yeah, I don't believe it was the DIA using directed energy weapons at Skinwalker Ranch. I mean, certainly they wouldn't want to do it against American citizens. They might have tried to use them against some of the various phenomena there. I don't know. But I don't see them, although, you know, the American government has done nasty things to its own military personnel and civilians in the past, as has the British government, you know, nuclear tests and, you know, and everything else. Mm-hmm. I don't think in this day and age that the DIA would be doing that. And certainly nobody that I speak to in the intelligence community would countenance that. I mean, that would be totally illegal. But if you're just going back to, you know, the adversarial side, you know, you don't want to, if you're Russia or China, you don't want to, you know, start overtly killing scientists or killing personnel or overtly, you know, kidnapping people, because that's obviously another thing. If you've got like a great scientist, you know, you potentially want him working for you, right?
Right.
If he's better than your scientist. So the next best thing, if you can't get to them, then you operate in the gray zone. So you want to try and kill them slowly or disable their capability to work. You don't want to do something that's an overt act of war. You'd want to infiltrate a program either with, you know, your own officers, or you'd want to subvert somebody to make them work as and have them work as an agent for you, because you want to get hold of that knowledge. You want to get hold of that research. You'd try hacking as well. And if you can't hack into the program because it's very, very heavily protected, then I said you might go after, you know, peripheral companies and scientists who are working indirectly for the program or directly for the program. Yeah. In the kind of like the supply chain of the research, effectively. Hacking is not always going to be possible. I've talked about kidnapping already. So really, mm-hmm. You'd want to stay in the kind of gray zone. So you'd be looking at kind of like sabotage and, you know, slowing down the program and trying to affect the scientists involved in it in malign ways. And I believe that quite possibly, and this is just a hypothesis, is what happened at Skinwalker. The Russians know that the DIA had interest in it and have interest in it. Then it's not beyond the bounds of the realms of possibility that they'd want to, you know, attack that research as well. But that's just my own opinion there. I haven't got anything to substantiate it.
Right. I don't know if you've seen the 60 Minutes piece or not, but it almost seemed like, I think it was the CIA agents that were being hit. They almost said that if it wasn't our government that was hitting them, it was some other government that was hitting them. But at the time they were saying that our government wasn't willing to cover their medical expenses, and they were denying that it was Havana syndrome that they were being hit with, or even any microwave energy whatsoever. Yet it was unexplained by doctors as to why they were having these symptoms.
I can't comment to that, but I mean, I don't see why, you know, whether it's in Havana or Moscow or, you know, somewhere in China, why would the Americans be taking out their own diplomats? I mean, they wouldn't.
Right. Yeah. So if these diplomats were being, and it was diplomats at the time, there were some diplomats, there were some CIA agents, there were some others that were featured in the article, or, you know, in the feature that was on CBS on 60 Minutes. To me, it was extremely unnerving how should I put this? If the U.S. government knows the technology exists, if behind closed doors they're very aware of it, how is it that they don't publicly, not publicly necessarily, you know, if they keep it on the down low and say, you know what, as long as you sign a non-disclosure and can keep quiet, we can treat you?
Well, yeah, I mean, there was a case of, I think it was Jim Peniston at, if you look at the Rendlesham Forest incident in 1980, I mean, he touched the craft these Air Force security policemen, including a lieutenant colonel, saw, and he received some kind of download, but he also received some kind of like long-term, you know, deleterious health effects. And for years and years, he tried to get his medical records from DOD. Effectively, and they were like, no, they don't exist. Eventually, I think he got hold of them. But it's not something that hasn't happened before. I think it's something that, you know, the U.S. government would want to keep under wraps. And also, you know, they wouldn't want to admit the fact that they haven't got a counter to it. But I mean, you know, governments aren't always great at taking care of their own people, right? You only have to look at, you know, sort of veterans coming back from Iraq, Afghanistan, and the various wars that, you know, the Americans, the Brits, and others have been involved in. They don't always look after their own personnel very well.
Right.
So I can't comment on the specifics. I can just sort of put my two pennies worth in.
Right, right. Kind of switching gears a little bit here, let's delve into the paranormal a little bit. We've mentioned Professor Gary Nolan, and you've mentioned him quite a bit throughout the hour. He's also one who's discovered that energy from UAPs has affected pilots and others with kind of the same effects as Havana syndrome, or has, I shouldn't say as Havana syndrome, but has affected people who have had experiences with UFOs, or has changed the chemistry of the brain of people who have had experience with UFOs. I was wondering if you could speak to that and the research behind that. I find it fascinating that it's changed the. It's a recent story, and we're really still getting down to the nitty gritty of how it changes the brain of an experiencer. Tell me, how much research have you done on that particular topic?
Sure. Well, I mean, in my first paper, I went kind of, you know, quite deeply into it, and there's a number of sort of declassified, open source and declassified papers that deal with it. The Project Condon report that I mentioned, the British Defense Intelligence 55 report. I mean, that's a 400-page report, and it's at the UK National Archives. That's well worth a look at. They talk about all kinds of effects on humans, animals, and equipment, posed by UAP. Also, as well, I mentioned in my first paper, Dr. Paul R. Hill, who was a NASA scientist. He was a senior propulsion and aeronautics engineering physicist at NASA, and also its predecessor, the National Advisory Committee of Aeronautics. And after he died in 1991, he published this book, which is called Unconventional Flying Objects. And he talks all about all kinds of sort of UAP, UFO weapon theories, and about how they can, you know, affect humans, whether it's radioactive or whether it's some kind of directed energy, which is affecting people. So, for example, talking about people's walls, cars, and water, can start vibrating. So it talks about field frequencies and ultrasonics. Mm-hmm. So this isn't anything new. And then also as well, Dr. Kit Green, he's talked about, the effects on tissues, brain tissues and neurological damage that can accrue to people who've been near UFOs. So I think Dr. Gary Nolan is really, kind of carrying that on. But I mentioned pretty much everybody apart from Dr. Gary Nolan in my first paper. But this is something that I think people have been looking at since at least the 1960s.
When we look at the type of effects that people have after having an encounter with whether you want to call it a UFO or a UAP or an alien or whatever you want to call it, can you traverse that or go backwards or reverse engineer that from the effects to figure out what kind of energy that is? I know we've speculated, but like, for example, if you take a type of cancer, and like, let's say me sitting here in the studio, I know I'm being bombarded by RF. I can figure out probably by the end of my life if I develop something, it may be, with the chances that I've been sitting around RF all my life, between radio and podcasting, I've been eating the wrong stuff, one or the other. Can you figure out through earthly means, and forgive me for my stammering here, Frank, but through earthly means, can we reverse engineer and try to figure out if there is an earthly energy that may possibly be used by a UAP that could be somewhat close? I mean, we take anti-gravity and think, well, we can come up with something that's close with anti-gravity that may be the same energy that they're using. But is there something that could potentially be made here on Earth that could be the same thing that they're using?
I mean, I think we can understand in terms of radiation effects, and there's been some very famous cases. Mm-hmm. There was the case of the Uinta Basin where Skinwalker Ranch is located, which was covered in a documentary, a very good documentary by Jeremy Corbell. So that involved a guy who ended up, I think, with MS and other deleterious health effects. And Dr. Hal Puthoff as well, who's been heavily involved in he was involved with ORSAP and government UAP programs. He's always said you don't want to be around a UFO when it's powering up. Yeah. Then there was in 1967, there was Falcon Lake, Manitoba. There's this guy called Stefan Michalak. He got too close to a UAP and he was trying to see if there was anybody inside. And the craft was powering up. So it sets his clothes on fire and it leaves him with a really bad burn mark across his stomach. And he's very ill. Then you had the 1980 Cash Landrum case in the USA, where two ladies were heavily sort of irradiated, hair falling out, burns, all the rest of it. So I think, we understand, or rather, medical experts and scientists understand the damage that's being caused to them. In fact, one of the scientists that I speak to, they say not only have they been damaged by directed energy weapons from malign actors, but they've also been in the vicinity of UFOs as well, which also produce these kind of malign effects. So I think scientists understand this quite well.
So the question, I guess, would be, should we consider these things hostile from a military standpoint and from a civilian standpoint?
I think you need to take it on a case-by-case basis. I think there have definitely been, hostile acts perpetrated by, intelligence behind UAP. You only have to look at Colares, Brazil in 1977, the Mantell case in the late 1940s. Also a case that I talked about in a recent podcast where effectively aircraft had disappeared, when they've merged plot with UAP. Also, I've done some in-depth studies on things like the 1976 Tehran case. You have to ask yourself, why would UAP insert themselves very close to like Navy carrier strike groups, advanced weapon systems and nuclear technology, both power plants and weapons. Why would they insert themselves over, nuclear facilities, ballistic missile silos and things like that? Hostility, are they displaying hostile intent? In some cases they have, in the many cases they haven't. I think if you're looking at air safety, they definitely pose an air safety risk, near collision with airliners and military aircraft, certainly, they pose an air safety risk. Whether that's hostile intent, whether they're doing that on purpose or whether it's just being careless or they simply don't care, it's very hard to say. Who are they and what are their intentions? And without knowing what their intentions are, you can't say. I think you have to take it in terms of a case-by-case basis and what the effects have been on people involved. So if somebody gets very badly radiation burned in the vicinity of a UAP, is that the UAP being hostile or is it just, they parked up and somebody walked too close and they got burned? Just like, you cross the road, and you don't look where you're going and you get clipped by a car. The person driving the car doesn't have hostile intent. But, he's in your vicinity and, you didn't realize the danger or you should have appreciated the danger and you ended up getting hit. So I take it very much on a case-by-case basis. I don't by any means subscribe to the kind of kumbaya syndrome of people who see, they put extraterrestrials or whatever the entities are on a kind of like a godlike pedestal and automatically assume that, they have some kind of benevolence and that they're looking out for us. I think that remains to be proved. Just as, are they hostile? That remains to be proved. But if you look, I mentioned Colares, 1977, there was very much malign activity perpetrated by UAP. And this has been commented on by, Dr. Egg Davis. There were, rays emitted from UAP, which caused harm and in some cases death to, Brazilian villagers on the ground.
So I guess I'd ask you this question. Is it... we have a lot of people in the paranormal community who preach the love and light part of aliens and that they're here to help us and here to save us from a government standpoint. Is there any case to that whatsoever or anything that you've seen in your experience that suggests anything like that?
I'd like to believe that, without being too anthropomorphic, just as there are kind of good people and bad people, there are people who go out of their way to do good in the world, right? And to spread love around and to help other people and you know, if you think of like a sort of like a Mother Teresa figure, or some of the people, you know, who've been canonized as saints, people who went out of their way to help others, you know, Saint Francis of Assisi, for example. But, you know, the vast majority of the human race aren't like that. We're basically pretty nasty on the whole. And so that's not to say even inherent goodness of entities. But, you know, it'd have to be on a case by case basis. If somebody, if you have a good experience, you see, there's a difference between believers and abductees, or experienced as abductees. If you're an abductee, then by definition, you've been abducted. So it's against your will, and you've had, you know, experiments done to you, which, you know, you didn't like very much, and it caused you pain. Although some might seem to start suffering, you know, kind of a sort of like a Stockholm syndrome, and start empathizing with the entities that are doing that. Okay, even though if somebody kidnapped, if a human kidnapped me from my house and did medical experiments on me, then that would be like the Nazis, right? Mm-hmm. That's what the Nazis did. But then other people, if you're an experiencer, it's like you've had a great experience and you've been in some kind of connection. And I can't deny people who claim to have good experiences or bad experiences, because I've talked to both, and there are simply too many people saying both. So I don't think you can say one or the other. I think you might. There's probably a mixture of you know, benign intelligences and malign intelligences, just as you find everywhere else in the universe. You find positive and negative. But I wouldn't go all out and say all intelligences behind UAP are completely benign and have our interests at heart. I mean, I just think that's an abrogation of responsibility, really.
You tell me if you can answer this question or not.
Sure.
As an intelligence agent, have you ever heard of someone of a high level rank in a government, or someone of importance being abducted or having an experience with an alien or a UAP that was either pleasant or non-pleasant?
I haven't personally, no.
No? Okay.
I mean, I've spoken to people, you know, military officers, intelligence officers who've had abduction experiences that were unpleasant.
Oh, all right.
But, you know, some people have told me they've had, you know, painful things done to them in the course of an abduction experience. And, but they didn't resent the fact, and they had some kind of communion, you know, with the intelligence behind it that did it. I mean, I can't speak for that, but I've spoken to people who've had very positive kind of experiences as well with experiences. I've said experiences as opposed to an abduction. But I think once anything is against your will, then I wouldn't find that personally to be pleasant. But I, you know, I'm not trying to tell other people what to think.
Right, right. Trying to come up with some stuff here that I've always been fascinated with here. Why I have you here, Frank?
Shoot.
And I'm trying to think of what you could actually answer too. I'm trying to be respectful of you.
I mean, look, ask anything you want, and I'll answer it as best I can. You know, there's no kind of boundaries here. Just
okay. All right, let's just out with it and say it. Do you know of or know if know that the government has or is working along with aliens?
That's a very interesting question. A couple of the people that I speak to say that they are in contact with what we call temporal agents, that is, future humans. Who've mastered time travel. Okay, they come back to manipulate timelines, some being malign, and mm-hmm. some for, you know, more positive reasons, but both inherently selfish, because they're coming back and they're manipulating things without our knowing about it. So in terms of aliens, no. I mean, I've heard the stories. I mean, if you're talking extraterrestrial, you know, the supposed meeting between, you know, President Eisenhower. There've been a number of, you know, supposed cases. I don't know. I keep an open mind. I think it's quite possible. I mean, mathematically, in terms of, you know, what could potentially be out there mathematically. Yeah, sure. There's got to be intelligent life somewhere. Whether they've got here yet, I don't know. I keep an open mind completely.
Interesting. Have you yourself had an experience with an alien or a UAP?
Yes, I have, and I'd be happy to discuss it with you offline.
Okay, yeah, we don't have to discuss it here. That's absolutely fine. I would ask you too. Do you, as an intelligence officer, are you worried that you're subject to something like Havana syndrome, or that someone will come after you with this exact same weapon?
I hope not.
I hope not too. I find you a very
really,
pleasant
because,
person.
I should stress this. I mean, I talk to a lot of very interesting people and I hear some very interesting things, but, you know, it's not classified people. I'm not in the loop that way. I'm no longer an intelligence officer. I mean, I left the military in the late 90s. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I've got some very interesting contacts, but, you know, I don't work on classified programs, and they'd be far better if you're a hostile actor. There's far better use of your resources than going after somebody like me. I mean, I'm not involved in a UAP program. You know, I write some stuff, but like none of it's classified. It's interesting, informed opinion that I get from scientists and others and theories, but I don't work on a classified program. And, you know, I taking me out wouldn't, you know, stop, you know, America or Great Britain advancing in some respect. So, no, right. I don't worry about it.
Okay. When you talk to different scientists, where do they see, especially since America is now kind of privatized space, do they ever see the U.S. government bringing it all back in house again, or have we pretty much privatized space for the long term?
Well, I think if you look at all the efforts have been going beyond behind the scenes, you know, with Luis Elizondo, the former head of the director of the Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program, and Chris Mellon, you know, former U.S. Undersecretary for Defense, to bring about kind of greater transparency in government over UAP. And now you've got, you know, the National Defense Authorization Act. And I strongly urge you and your listeners, go and download the NDAA. Go to page, I think it's 378. Anyway, look for unexplained aerial phenomena, and it will come all up about, you know, the formation of an office to examine UAP. It talks all about the potential threat from adversaries. It talks about the interest that UAP have in nukes. But if you look at Chris Mellon and Elizondo, what I think they're really trying to do with that is they're trying to get congressional oversight of all these disparate special access programs and unacknowledged special access programs that have been operating across the Department of Energy or run out of the Department of Energy and the DOD, but are basically in privatized hands. I'm told that the U.S. government has advanced technologies that are held in private hands that are made available to the U.S. government as and when required. But for security reasons, because they're beyond effectively the American FOIA process, they're kept in private hands. And also because the efforts to understand them, whether it's trying to understand recovered craft, or whether it's trying to reverse engineer them and produce a kind of like a substandard copy that doesn't have all the kind of five observables, right, of the UAP that we see. And I'm told that America will be there in the next two decades. I believe that Elizondo and Mellon, basically, they pushed this greater transparency and move for congressional oversight, because for the last 70 years, there's been too much secrecy. There's been too many kind of disparate programs. They want to bring it all under one roof. And if you look at my second paper, which was American Development of UAP Technology, a fait accompli, Elizondo actually uses those words. The former director of the Advanced Aerospace Threat Identification Program, he actually says in my paper, Congress understands the importance of it, they'll allocate the funds. You know, because I said, you know, the question was posed, you know, do you want to have like, you know, $23 billion program effectively to study UAP, just as you would the F-35, the F-22, or whatever. So that was the title of my paper, and I think that's what they want to do. There's been far too much secrecy for too long. That doesn't mean that they're gonna hang everything out for the public, but they want to reunite all these different programs under a kind of like a Manhattan Project too. So you bring all these disparate programs from aerospace and defense companies, you bring them under one roof and you provide greater accountability, because that's been one area that's been lacking on UAP is accountability. And that way, if you have a stumbling block in one area, and Eric Davis has talked about this, you know, he said you can't just go and talk to a scientist in another special access program if you're trying to figure out like how a recovered UAP works or trying to reverse engineer it. So they want to bring all these programs under one roof, and then you can kind of cross-pollinate the information between the various special access programs and get advancement and get there before the Russians and the Chinese do. That's what I believe. And that's been the sort of focus of my research in my second paper. Anybody interested, you can see both my papers. Just put Frank with a C, Frank Milburn, into Google, and it should come up like straight away, or go to the Begin Sadat Center for Strategic Studies website, and you can download the papers there. But it's the second paper, talks all about, you know, funding and the likelihood of having a program, a big program, studying unexplained aerial phenomena.
Awesome. Let me ask you this, Frank. We had a little bit of a period last year where the U.S. government, I think, was in the throes of soft disclosure. Of course, you know, we got the videos that were released, and I think the American public didn't know what to do with it. I mean, we looked at the videos. Of course, you had the skeptics that came forward and said, nah, I don't know what to think of it. You know, it, you know, you got everything from, eh, you know, it's grainy black and white video. You could do anything with grainy black and white video. You know, I can shoot better stuff from, you know, from a bad video. Why is it grainy black and white? Why is it this? Why is it that? And of course, you know, everyone's jaded. I'm wondering, I want to get your take on the videos, first of all, that came out last year. What did you have to make of what came out last year?
Well, in terms of videos, I mean, there's a lot more supporting information as well. It's not just, you know, the videos itself, but it's also, you know, the other sensors, right? Whether it's like, you know, satellite, you know, radars, and also what the pilots saw physically with their own eyes,
right,
with the Mark I eyeball. Mm-hmm. I've got no doubt whatsoever. I mean, you know, the Nimitz case, 2004, I've got no doubt that, you know, Commander David Fravor saw what he saw. I've also spoken to pilots myself, and I've got no doubt that they've seen what they've seen, you know, whether it's Ryan Graves or whoever. I've got absolutely no doubt. I mean, military people are trained to be observant by nature because your life depends on it, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So whether you're an intelligence officer, you know, you're sitting in a bush somewhere, and you know you have to be able to identify a vehicle correctly, and what kind of antenna, you know, does it have, or what kind of radar dome? Okay, that means that it's like a divisional level, you know, anti-aircraft, you know, regiment command vehicle type thing, right? So you've got to understand all these things, and pilots are highly professional because their lives depend on it, right?
Right.
They're
right.
Being able to detect friend from foe. So there's absolutely no doubt in my mind. I think people are disappointed just because a lot of people, you know, skeptics. You know, to be honest, I really couldn't care less what they think. I mean, I'm always looking for, you know, the more prosaic, you know, solution. But I think, you know, when highly experienced and highly trained people, and I'd be worried if people that you've spent millions of dollars on, right, to fly fast jets and to deliver weapon systems, like with precision behind enemy lines, right? I'd be very worried if they weren't able to identify things that are not a commercial jet, that's not another military jet, and that's not an adversarial, you know, jet. So, you know, I have faith in that way. There are a lot of people, yeah, they want to debunk the videos, this or that. I think Chris Leto is a former lieutenant colonel of the US Air Force. He's a very good guy to look at on YouTube. He's done some really, really fantastic breakdowns. And again, you know, he flew fast jets. He kind of knows what he's talking about. He's used those similar, you know, targeting pods to the ones that, you know, the US Navy have used. So I'd really say to skeptics, have you sat in a plane? Have you been in a fast jet? Have you managed all those sensors? No, then you probably don't know what you're talking about.
That's true. It's very true. I myself, you know, I wondered if the U.S. government doesn't trust its own people, because I think to myself, I don't trust our own people, because I think if you just threw disclosure out there, or just told everybody, okay, here are the files, here's what we have, here's everything we have on UAP, and honestly, here's everything we have up to speed, I don't think our people could digest it. I mean, even though we've had, you know, for years we've had movies that have featured alien life, and we've gotten the whole shebang, either people would be completely turned off to it and wouldn't care, they're absorbed by everyday life, or they would look at it and be completely overwhelmed. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that with the NDAA, and I'm just looking at it now, it is page 577. I think people are just now, because it's now been signed into law about UAP. I mean, it says here, establishment of office, organizational structures and authorities to address identified aerial phenomena, right? And you had the report from the Office of the Director of National Intelligence and the UAP Task Force, right, last June, mm-hmm. okay, on UAP. So the fact that the American government is now openly looking at it, and the fact that they've said that, you know, some things can't be explained and, you know, are not adversarial, And you've had so many former officials, whether it's, you know, the John Radcliffe, you know, the former director of national intelligence, the current director of national intelligence, people like Lou Elizondo, Harry Reid, so many people. And also, let's not forget President Obama. Right.
Yeah.
He's been talking about it, too. So I think now people can kind of get their head around it and think, OK, we might not be alone in the universe. But they're still kind of thinking in terms of, you know, like E.T., extraterrestrial, people visiting us in kind of physical craft. I think what's going to really blow people's minds and what they can't get their head around is the kind of the wider kind of weird and weird strangeness or high strangeness, as Dr. Jack Vallée and Eric Davis have written about it, you know, the kind of high strangeness of the various phenomena, things like at Skinwalker Branch, you know, the poltergeist activity, you know, the cryptids, you know, the fact that all these things seem to have the disembodied voices, the things, you know, the fact that UAP and these kind of phenomena seem to happen like in one area, very close together and seem to be kind of interconnected in some way, perhaps, you know, cattle mutilations. That's where I think people's going to be problematic for people to get their head around, you know, the fact that, that, you know, the phenomena, you know, can make exsanguinate cattle and zap dogs and fill people with, you know, the sort of adrenal kind of a pheromonal fear. That, you know, it can control people's minds. I think those are things that people are going to have a real big problem getting their heads around. The fact that there's invisible entities that may have malign or benign intentions that are operating around us and you can't see them. You know, that there's a whole kind of like a different kind of parallel world of existence that kind of intersects with our own. I think that is what people are going to have a very hard problem getting their head around. I've kind of been experienced all my life. So while some aspects of it, you know, freak me out very heavily and I don't want to get involved with it, I've kind of been drawn back in. I mean, I started with sort of nuts and bolts UFOs in 2016. I mean, I'd had some exposure to it in the military, but having been subjected to the kind of wider phenomena, and also, you know, things have kind of got weirder and spookier since I've started doing researching as well, like things, you know, different things have been happening. So I think those are the difficult things that people are going to not want to get their head around. And I think people who are just abject skeptics, I think, yes, you want to have evidence. You want to, you know, look for the most prosaic explanation that there is. But some things that you have to kind of, you know, open your mind to as well. And I just think for some people, they close off and they say, no, this can't possibly be happening just because it's a terrifying paradigm for them.
That it is. It's not, we can sit and talk about it on a podcast. We can sit and read a book about it. We can sit and be safe behind something and not realize exactly what it is. But the minute you come face to face with it, it's a whole different deal.
Yeah, but I think, you know, Lou Elizondo, he made a great point. He was talking about, you know, when the sort of the early ages of sail. I mean, like a lot of people, they were terrified. They were terrified to get on ships and to go sailing, right? Because they thought either they'll fall off the edge of the earth or they'll get dragged underwater by mermaids or, like, you know, there'll be some kind of kraken-like monster. And then, you know, they realized actually, yeah, you've got giant squid and whales and giant kind of giant creatures of the deep, but they're not actually monsters per se. They're just a part of our natural world. It remains to be seen whether these phenomena are a part of our natural world. Is it like, is it technology or is it some kind of, is it actually, you know, sort of like living entities? Mm-hmm. So, and how they interact with us. I mean, that's a very key question. It's fundamental to our own understanding about ourselves and the world around us. I mean, just because, you know, we can't see something, you go out and stare at the night sky, you can look up at the stars, it's all beautiful. If you take, you know, like a night vision equipment out with you, you're going to see a lot more because, you know, your eyes can't see on, you know, through different spectra of light, right?
Right.
So I think that's the same with our existence. Some people, you know, that they might call gifted people, like my grandmother was one of them and my mother as well, who would see, you know, entities you would describe as ghosts, you know, things like that. You know, there's people who are described as gifted or talented, or I particularly don't want to have the gift, right? But there's people who've been in touch with that since kind of recorded human time. There've been people who are more in touch than others, and I just think maybe better to embrace it and to kind of understand it than to just kind of like deny it.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
The good and the bad.
The good and the bad. Absolutely. Yeah. I think we'll leave it at that note. That I think we've sufficiently probably scared people today, Frank. I think we've.
No, I mean, that wasn't my intention.
But, No. I know. It's kind of chilling when you think about it, not only from Havana Syndrome to the things that are going on that we can't see. I think that's the things that we covered today. I mean,
Well, you know, they say forewarned is forearmed, right?
That's right. You're absolutely right. Forearmed is forewarned. Forewarned.
Forewarned.
four, yeah, something like that. Yeah, I have a hard time keeping things straight at my age, Frank, that's for sure. Like Frank mentioned, go on to Google and look up Frank Milburn, F-R-A-N-C, Frank Milburn, and check out those two papers that are there on Google. You'll see them there. We'll try and get links too up on the description of the show so that you can follow those papers and read those papers of Frank's. They're quite fascinating, and Frank himself is quite a fascinating man. Frank, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. It's fascinating stuff. It all is very fascinating stuff. And I want you to come on over to Darkness Radio and join us over there too. We'll have some discussions over there too, my friend.
I'd absolutely love to, and it's been a real honor. It's been a fascinating conversation. You have certain conversations with people that just kind of like flow, which is I really enjoy.
It was all my pleasure. I truly enjoyed this conversation, and I look forward to having you over on Darkness Radio, and we'll continue the high strangeness over there as well. Folks, if you're a free listener to True Crime Tuesday and are on the free feed, it's time for us to bid you adieu. You don't have to, though. Not if you're a subscriber to Stitcher Premium. It's real simple. Just go to Stitcher.com, sign up for Stitcher Premium. It's $5 a month, and you'll be able to continue on with us by listening to Dumb Crimes and Stupid Criminals. Lots of hilarious stories about mishaps and melees and Florida Man and all kinds of stuff. It's $5 a month. Just go to Stitcher.com and click on the Premium button to sign up for Dumb Crimes, Stupid Criminals, the ad-free version of Darkness Radio, and hundreds of podcasts that you can expand your audio horizons with. Stitcher.com and click on that Premium button. But, alas, you're listening to the free version, so at this time, we'll bid you adieu.